Hello everyone, and welcome back to the History of Africa podcast. I'm your host, Andy. Last episode, we examined the role of the Garamanti civilization in early trans-Saharan trade, with nomads from Fezzan carrying goods from West Africa to the markets of the North African Carthaginian Empire, and vice versa. However, the history of the Sahara, and the world, will change forever when a new powerhouse enters the scene, and replaces Carthage as the dominant power on the Mediterranean. How will the Garamantes react when they meet their new northern neighbors, the Empire of Rome? The title might give away a little bit of how this relationship is going to go. Season 5, Episode 4, The Roman Invasion of the Sahara. By 150 BC, the Carthaginian Empire, once the most powerful and influential state in North Africa, was a shell of its former self. The empire had fought a war against the Roman Republic 5 years earlier, the famous Second Punic War, you know, the one with Hannibal crossing the Alps, war elephants, all that stuff. Despite some tremendous early victories, the war ended in crippling defeat for the Carthaginians. The Romans imposed harsh conditions on their former enemies, including the disbanding of much of Carthage's military, the loss of valuable territories in Spain, and crippling financial indemnities. Without their once powerful military, Carthage began to slowly lose their grip even on other North African territories to rebellions from their Amazigh clients. A group of Roman senators decided to finish off the weakened state in 149 BC. Using a war with a Roman allied kingdom as an excuse, the Romans invaded Carthage and captured the city, brutally and thoroughly destroying it. This is a major tragedy for scholars of the Garamantes as well as scholars of the Carthaginians, since the Carthaginians were a literate culture, and likely wrote more extensively about their southern neighbors, their culture, diplomatic interactions, trade, politics, and more than anyone else in the world. But due to the intense and thorough leveling of the city in the Third Punic War, almost all Carthaginian texts were lost, including those that they would have written about the Garamantes. Following the destruction and conquest of Carthage, the Romans took up the new mantle as the dominant power in Northwest Africa. At first, they placed the region under the rule of allied Amazigh kingdoms, before eventually annexing it outright, transforming the region into the Roman province called Africa, consisting of modern-day Tunisia and coastal Libya. Fun fact, this Roman province of Africa is where the name Africa, as in the continent, came from, as the name would eventually become a more general name for the continent as a whole beyond this particular region. This, however, begs a second question. Where did the Romans get this name from? Our newest premium episode on Patreon will focus on this question, examining the shockingly unclear origin of the name Africa. Is Africa yet another foreign name imposed on the continent by a colonial power? Or, in an odd twist, might Africa be the only continent in the world with an endonym, or a name originating from its own shores? Go and support us on patreon.com/historyofafrica to listen to this episode and learn more about the origin of the name Africa and, substantially well, the name of this whole podcast. And to those already supporting the show and enjoying our 50-plus premium episodes, a heartfelt thank you. Anyways, as the Romans began the process of integrating and administrating their new province, they soon found themselves facing a problem. That problem being their southern neighbors, the Garamantes. When and why the relationship between Rome and the Garamantes became so sour is not especially clear. One Roman source, the historian Pliny the Elder, describes the war as being caused by a Roman desire to break the Garamantian monopoly on trans-Saharan trade. In one part of Pliny's Natural History, he provides a description of how the Garamantes exploited their knowledge of underground water to eliminate foreign commercial competition, and to keep Roman merchants out of the burgeoning trade route. Reading from Pliny, quote, "Up to the present time, it has been found impracticable to keep the road open that leads to the country of the Garamantes, as the predatory bands of that nation have filled up the wells with sand, which do not require to be dug for any great depth, if you only have a knowledge of the locality." Basically, the Garamantes hid the locations of their wells, ensuring that any merchants trying to pass through the region would have to rely on local guides to be able to find water, and as a result, ensure that they could take a portion of the profits as middlemen. However, another Roman historian, Tacitus, instead identified the root of the conflict as something else entirely, as being rooted in Garamantian raids along Roman border towns and the enslavement of their residents. Perhaps both narratives hold some truth, that Rome had a long-standing desire to break the Garamantian monopoly, and that Garamantian raids provided the necessary justification for Rome to fulfill its goal of crushing the Garamantian control over Trans-Saharan trade. To lead the campaign, the Romans called on a man whose family may have roots closer to the conflict than you might expect. Lucius Cornelius Balbus Minor was the proconsul, or military leader, of the province of Africa, tasked with leading the Roman legions within the province. This is interesting because Balbus was not, in fact, Roman. Rather, he was from the city of Gades, or Cadiz, in modern-day Spain, a city that was closely linked and at times even governed by Rome's archenemy, Carthage. Balbus was descended from the local Phoenician population, and given the Carthaginian Empire's own Phoenician roots and presence in the area, his family likely had distant ties back to Carthage itself. Balbus also happened to be incredibly lucky to be from this city. See, most people within the Roman Empire, especially its conquered provinces, were not considered Roman citizens. However, Gades was an exception, the city where all of its free residents had been given naturalized citizenship due to a long-standing and close relationship with Rome. The city, for reference, had the largest population of upper-class citizens outside of the Italian peninsula, which included Balbus's family among their ranks. Even more luckily, Balbus's family happened to have close connections to the political faction of Julius Caesar and, after his assassination, also his adoptive son Octavian, the future first emperor of Rome. His own proconsularship over Africa was secured through his family's political connections. In his position of proconsul of Africa, Balbus soon adopted a hawkish persona, becoming dead set on war with the Garamantes. Beyond serving the economic interests of his adoptive country and the province he commanded, Balbus also, of course, had selfish reasons for promoting the war, too. Roman society placed a great deal of honor and prestige on foreign conquest, and so such foreign conquest would be a major career milestone for Balbus, with a victory abroad winning him great fame and prestige within Rome. And, well, if you're governing the province of North Africa, there was only one direction to conquer, south. So far, the Garamantian kingdom, with its dry roads leading to cities with secret water sources, remained a destination just beyond Roman reach. Balbus sought to change this frontier, and become the first Roman to conquer land in the Sahara, and maybe even open up an avenue for further conquest beyond. In 19 BC, Balbus and an army of 10,000 Roman legionaries began their march south into the lands of the Garamantes. Along with foot infantry, the Romans brought with them a unique and useful animal, rarely before seen in this part of the Sahara. For the last few decades before Balbus's war, Rome had also been engaged in wars throughout the Middle East, and therefore had adopted a popular local mount for use in their desert campaigns, the dromedary camel. While camels have become basically synonymous with life in the Sahara today, it's crazy to think about the fact that at the time of Balbus's invasion, the animals were basically entirely absent from the Sahara. Dromedary camels were ubiquitous throughout the arid landscapes of Arabia and some parts of East Africa. In fact, they might have been first domesticated by humans in the lands of modern Somalia. But their use had stopped there for centuries. The animals were known in ancient Egypt from a very early time and were used on rare occasions, but they never supplanted donkeys and horses as the main method of transport throughout the Sahara Desert. Camels had slowly trickled into Egypt, mostly for use in trading across the Sinai Desert, connecting them into West Asia, but when it came to the Sahara, the animals remained sparsely used. As it turned out, camels, with their wide, sprawling feet, evolved not to sink into sand, as well as their drought-resistant nature, were a perfect fit for transit through the Sahara. As Balbus prepared his armies for an invasion of the hostile Sahara, they figured the camel would be a helpful commodity, and used them extensively as both war mounts and supply carriers during the conflict. Because of this widespread use by Balbus, camels would become an increasingly common sight throughout the Sahara following his invasion. Keep that in mind, as the introduction of camels into the Sahara will become important later. The Roman historian Pliny the Elder gives us a general account of Balbus' invasion. The forces began on the northern coast, near the city of Leptis Magna, and began marching slowly southward. At first, they faced little resistance. The northernmost group of people living in the Sahara were a group of nomadic herdsmen called the Nesamones, one of the many nomadic groups of people who drifted in and out of the Garamantian sphere of influence. Likely figuring that this fight wasn't really theirs, they surrendered without putting up a fight. After 12 days further south, Balbus's army encountered a group of settled people living in caves, and 4 days after that, the Romans finally arrived in the Fezzan. Pliny implies that the political situation in the Fezzan was one of increasing centralization under the city of Garama. While he alludes to the existence of dozens of small city-states, there are only three of them that he identifies as being anything more than vassals of the city of Garama. By this point, only the cities of Alale, Silaba, and Sidamu remained ostensibly independent of Garamantian rule. A few days later, the Romans finally arrived at the northern frontier of direct Garamantian sovereignty, a frontier town called Telgoe, before capturing the city and shortly thereafter marching on Garama itself. Despite the logistical challenges that they must have faced fighting in the desert, the Romans emerged victorious in Balbus's expedition, successfully besieging and capturing Garama itself, as well as several other key Garamantian cities. Additionally, according to Pliny, they built a few forts in the area as well to try and establish a more permanent Roman presence. Though these forts were apparently rudimentary and temporary enough in their architecture that none of them survive today. In fact, it's possible that the Romans under Balbus may have pushed even further beyond the Sahara and into the Sahel. The main evidence for this claim comes from Pliny, who states that after pushing deep into Garamantian territory, Balbus and his men continued further south until they reached a river, which the Romans called Dasibari. Of course, there are no permanent rivers in Libya, which has led some experts to conclude that the Dasibari must have been a name that the Romans gave to the Niger River. This name, Dasibari, may have even been based on a local name for the river that the men encountered during their expedition, as there is a plausible link between the name Dasibari and the current Songhai name for the Niger River, Isabari. On the other hand, though, Pliny's description of the geography of the region might imply otherwise. See, Pliny describes there being a major mountain range to the south of the Dasibari. And while there are some hills to the south of the Niger River, identifying them as Pliny's mountains might be a bit of a stretch. It might be more likely that the Dasibari was not necessarily a river at all, but rather a high-volume wadi, simply during a wet period, and that the southern mountains described by Pliny were the Tibesti mountain range of northern Chad. While it's unclear whether or not Balbus ever made it south of the Sahara, what is clear is that his expedition left an enormous impact on those within it. Now, it's worth noting that Balbus's conquest of the Garamantes would remain incredibly short-lived. While the Romans could beat them in battle, they also knew that trying to govern these captured territories across a hostile desert would be a much harder and more expensive endeavor, and therefore never really tried to do so. Balbus returned to the city of Rome as a war hero, celebrating a triumph or major public celebration of his victory. And while it falls outside the purview of this show, I do think it's interesting to note that this was the first time ever a naturalized Roman citizen celebrated a triumph, and the last time ever that a non-imperial family member would celebrate a triumph, marking the transition of Rome into a simultaneously more cosmopolitan and nepotistic era. Anyways, as Balbus and his legionaries left the Sahara, the Garamantes remained a battered, but still independent entity. The Romans had undermined their ability to control and profit from trade routes passing through their territory, but it turned out that, ironically, this beating at the hands of Rome would be a blessing in disguise for the Garamantes. While certainly bruised, the best fortunes of the Garamantes were still yet to come. However, when the Garamantes do eventually cross that horizon, they will soon find that it's all downhill from there. Join us for our next episode, as we survey the city of Garama at its absolute height in the so-called classical period of Garamantes history, while also examining some of the brewing problems that were beginning to make themselves known, and that will eventually lead to the collapse of this fascinating civilization. Thank you for listening to the History of Africa podcast. If you like our show, then we would greatly appreciate if you could help support the show and our project of freely available online history education. You can do this by supporting us at patreon.com/historyofafrica, providing us a rating or review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or iTunes,
or by sharing the podcast with anyone who you think might enjoy learning about African history.
This episode is brought to you by our supporters on Patreon, including Naomi Kanakia, Iofag Bamiye, Dimitri, Alexander Travis, BB Milliam, Conrad Schwenke, Johnny Knowles, Godfrey Sebelabie, Pascal Mokocha, Joe Maxwell, Nkechi Nwabudike, Sheunu Rontimain, Kwajo Amankwa, Douglas Harder and Sherry Robinson, Craig Bolton, Samuel Badeau, Ghassan Virgiani, Ni T, Kitty, Tariq Beetleman, Kelvin J. Anoris, and Ellen Fisher, among others. Thank you all for supporting the show. It really, really, really means a lot.